Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Rackman Review. I'm Andrew England, the Middle East editor of the Financial Times, standing in for Gideon Rackman. In this edition, we're looking at Iran under its new president, Ibrahim Raisi, a hardline cleric who won the Islamic Republic's presidential election in June. He replaces Hassan Rouhani, a pragmatist and architect of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, which Tehran signed with world powers. My guest this week is Sanam Vakil, the Deputy Director of the Middle East North Africa Programme at Chatham House in London, where she focuses on Iran and Gulf Arab dynamics. So what impact will the change of leadership have on Iran's relations with the rest of the world? Raisi, a former judiciary chief and a protege of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, took office earlier this month and suggested that regional issues would be at the core of his foreign policy.
Foreign interference in the region won't resolve any problems. It's a problem itself. I extend the hand of friendship and brotherhood to all regional countries, especially our neighbours.
He has ended the presidency at a critical time for both Iran and the region. Diplomatic efforts are expected to resume to secure a deal between Tehran and the Biden administration that would lead to sanctions being lifted on the Republic and the US rejoining the nuclear accord abandoned by Donald Trump in 2018. But Iran would also have to agree to reduce its atomic activity and fall back into compliance with the accord. Raisi will also face domestic pressures as the Iranian economy reels from the crippling impact of sanctions imposed by Trump, while many Iranians have become increasingly disillusioned with the theocratic regime.
Protesters have been chanting against Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and the protests have spread across Iran to other cities too. Dozens are taking place across the country every week about various issues like power cuts, low wages and work conditions.
Fewer than half of Iran's registered voters bothered to cast ballots at the June election.
Another deterrent for pro-reform voters was a lack of choice. That's after the Guardian Council, a hardline election body, barred heavyweight moderates and conservatives from standing.
Analysts believe Raisi was Khamenei's preferred candidate, as the 82-year-old supreme leader seeks to ensure the regime's survival and a smooth succession after his death. Raisi's victory means hardliners are in full control of all branches of the state for the first time in almost a decade, and it is expected to further expand the influence of the Revolutionary Guards, or IRGC, the elite force that is a dominant power in the Republic and which is responsible for Iran's military operations across the region. Sanam Vakil has written about Iran's so-called deep state and the complicated power dynamics within the Republic. So when I spoke to her this week, I began by asking her whether the change of presidency from Rouhani to Raisi would make any real difference to government policy in Iran, where the supreme leader is the ultimate decision maker.
I think if you sort of look into the presidential history, you'll see that most Iranian presidents have not been successful at leaving their mark. So that does show they are limited in their ability to be independent as actors. Ibrahim Raisi matters, though, because he comes from the conservative hardline establishment. He is believed to be ideologically and personally closer to Iran's supreme leader. And I think he demonstrates, coming from the security and intelligence establishment around the supreme leader that I have referred to in my work as the Iranian deep state, that they would like to focus on domestic issues. They are seeking to reduce factional competition and portray a sense of unity within the political system.
A lot of people are kind of speculating what this means for the Revolutionary Guards. Obviously, you know, they are the elite force that are blamed for backing and supporting a lot of the militant groups in the region that Iran's enemies and critics say destabilizing, causing conflict in the region. You know, they're blamed for attacks on tankers in the Gulf, attacks on Israeli tankers. Now, some people suggest that he's close to the Revolutionary Guards and his government will embolden and strengthen the Revolutionary Guards, and they're becoming an even more dominant force in the system. Do you see it that way?
Well, because I sort of look at the Iranian political establishment as having had a deep state, I see the Revolutionary Guards as part of that deep state, not separate to that deep state. And that deep state is also composed of members of the intelligence establishment, institutions, economic conglomerates. And it's a group of institutions and individuals that come together to protect the revolutionary ideology, integrity, and survivability of the Islamic Republic. And Raisi is someone closely associated with this group, this cabal. I think he's not necessarily going to embolden the IRGC per se, but he is going to be a mouthpiece that supports the vision, the policies, the views of the security-minded establishment. And that includes support for Iran's forward defense policy in the region, designed to push threats away from Iran's borders, supporting proxy groups and using leverage-based asymmetric practices like drone attacks and investment in Iran's ballistic missile program to protect the Islamic Republic from its perceived threats. So that is very much going to continue.
Before the election, which was in June, Iran was holding negotiations with the remaining signatories to the nuclear accord, the UK, France, Germany, China, and Russia, in a bid to see if they could strike a deal which would lead to the Biden administration rejoining the nuclear deal. Obviously, Donald Trump abandoned it in 2018. That led to a big escalation in the region. The US and Iran came to the brink of war. And the Biden administration, when it came in, it said, look, we'll go back to the nuclear accord and lift sanctions if Iran falls back into compliance. Now, the talks were taking place in Vienna, and there were some suggestions they were making progress, and then we had elections. Now, as we said, Rouhani was an architect of the deal, and now you have a Raisi government close to the hardline centers of power. How do you think this will impact the chances of the revival of the nuclear deal and the US and Iran being able to get an agreement which does see America rejoin it?
Well, President Raisi, during the campaign and even in his inauguration speech, lent support to the JCPOA talks. I do think, though, that when the talks resume, and they're expected to resume in September, once Raisi's cabinet is approved and the new nuclear team is put together, once Iran returns to that table, we'll have, of course, a better sense of the demands. There have been leaks of those demands in the press. And I think principal to all of those demands that, you know, deal with sanctions relief, timing of Iranian compliance, is the issue of sustainability. I think that the Raisi administration is driven by the need to get a better deal. I don't think they want to change the integrity of the JCPOA, but from their perspective, they are not going to return Iran to compliance without certain guarantees that the deal won't be unraveled again in a few years, depending on the whims of an American president. That sort of volatility in the Iranian economy is something that I don't think they can afford. So they're going to be looking for workarounds. And this is sort of tricky because European powers, the UK and the United States, don't feel like they can provide those guarantees. But they're going to be looking for workarounds and assurances that the deal will be protected. So I think that is what is going to be the biggest sticking point in Vienna when everybody goes back.
On the other side of that as well, I mean, a key thing in all of this is the pressure on the US from its allies in the Middle East, particularly Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but also in Europe to a degree, that Iran also has to make concessions on its support for militant groups in the region, groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, like the Houthis in Yemen, the Hashid in Iraq, and also on its very muscular development of its increasingly sophisticated missile and drone program. Is there any chance that Iran will move on that?
And in our work at Chatham House, have conducted research and interviews that have looked at sort of the process. And most of our findings have pointed to the fact that the JCPOA is the most important entry point to stabilize Iran's nuclear program, to build back some level of trust between Iran and the international community, and then to use that trust to launch into these other very critical areas. What the Biden administration is trying to do, and I think they're right to do it, they're trying to hinge sanctions relief to Iran's agreement that it will return to the negotiating table to discuss its ballistic missile and drone program and its support for hybrid actors and proxy groups around the region. I don't see the Raisi administration making any such agreements in the short run. Perhaps over time, those issues can be discussed. But from Tehran's perspective, it doesn't see itself as the only country that supports proxy groups or has a ballistic missile program in the region. So any such participation and discussion on these issues from Tehran's perspective will have to be regionalized. And Iran will probably seek the same level of accountability on other states in the region. And I think the same can be applied for support for non-state actors around the region as well.
During Raisi's inauguration, he made it very clear that regional policy would be the kind of key element of his foreign policy. And before the Taliban's extraordinary blitz across Afghanistan over the past week, there were talks between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad since April, I think at least three rounds of talks. Raisi said that he wanted to extend his hand of friendship to neighbors. And now we've got the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan. And obviously the Taliban are, you know, a historical enemy of Iran. It's a Sunni militant group, and Iran is the main Shia power in the region. How do you think what's happening in Afghanistan impacts on Iran and the regional dynamics?
It's an interesting question. The Iranian government, as you said, has, particularly in the 90s, had high levels of tension with the Taliban and mobilized its troops to a border in 1997 to push back against the killing of a number of Iranian diplomats. But at the same time, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and the presence of the United States on Iran's Afghan border, but also eventually on Iraqi border, was a bigger threat for Iran. And so the security establishment, the IRGC, has through the years developed diversified, multifaceted ties with a variety of different Afghan groups, including the Taliban, in order to push back against the U.S. presence. And since Iran has over four decades called for the removal of U.S. troops in the Middle East, there is a constituency within the political establishment in Iran that is very much supporting the U.S. withdrawal. And they see what's taking place in Afghanistan as a manageable threat and an opportunity for Iran to assert its influence the way it has done in other chaotic situations. For example, after the 2003 Iraq War, over time, Iran developed a network, leveraged that network, began to support that network financially, built militias throughout the country. I won't say that it's going to employ that same model. It has different layers of support in Afghanistan, but it has worked with the Taliban. It has worked to empower the Taliban over the past few years as well. So while this is seen as a security threat, and the Iranian people in particular are hugely concerned about the potential for terrorism and radicalization on Iran's border, I think the IRGC has cut its teeth in Afghanistan. So I think they're going to try their best to manage this situation opportunistically and close down opportunities for external powers, such as Saudi Arabia, to destabilize Iran's security interests on its border.
Is there the risk that Afghanistan becomes another theater of regional competition between Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE? I mean, is that a risk that, you know, instead of de-escalation, we see another theater where competition, rivalry, support for rival groups, whatever, you know, plays out?
Of course, there's always a risk. And much of this very much depends on how the UAE, Saudi, and Iran have digested the past 3-4 decades of history. If they see their support for proxy groups in Afghanistan as having been successful, which I don't think they have. I think, you know, they've all experienced blowback and domestic instability as a result of these policies. You know, then of course everything could repeat itself. But, you know, for Iran, Afghanistan is also important because it is a security interest and a gateway also for China. And having a stable Afghanistan over a longer period of time, I think, hinges Iran as an important player for China, where it has built stronger economic and political links over multiple decades. And just last year, there was an announcement of Iran's 25-year agreement with China. We don't have, you know, details of those arrangements, but I think that both countries see stability in Afghanistan and sort of transit through Central Asia as important to the relationship.
Do you think the Raisi government is genuine when it says that it wants to extend the hand of friendship to its regional neighbors? I mean, the hostility between Saudi Arabia and Iran has been particularly strong. Obviously, the Saudi embassy was ransacked in 2016 after Saudi Arabia executed a senior Shia cleric. And Saudi government was a big backer of Trump's maximum pressure against Iran. And the Saudis would say, we always hear the words, what we want to see is action.
It's a tough one. I think that the Iranians are sincere in their intent. What remains unclear, as you alluded to, is if Iran is willing to take action. And, you know, the Saudis ultimately are seeking a shift in Iran's position of support for the Houthis in Yemen, and ultimately also a quote-unquote change in Iranian behavior writ large throughout the region. I think that what could be achieved, and I think what the Raisi government hopes to achieve, is perhaps a similar detente to that we have seen between Iran and the UAE. If you remember in 2019, when Iran launched what it refers to as its maximum resistance campaign to push back against the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement, it not only took to accelerate its nuclear program, but it began to sponsor attacks in the Middle East and in the Persian Gulf and detained ships and tankers, and also was behind the September 2019 attacks on Saudi oil facilities. The UAE immediately reached out to Iran and they began a bilateral de-escalation that was tactical to protect the UAE from direct Iranian attacks. And I think that that is something that could be achievable, particularly with a greater concern about U.S. de-escalation, uncertainty over security concerns in Afghanistan. A de-escalation could be mutually beneficial for both Riyadh and Tehran and could allow both countries to prioritize some of their bigger challenges. Saudi Arabia needs a regional stability to put more muscle behind Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince's Vision 2030, to attract foreign investment in the kingdom and diversify away from, energy dependency. And Iran has broader domestic as well as security challenges. So, you know, there's an argument to be made there, but it ultimately requires tactical concessions on both sides.
And in the background to all this is this shadow war between Israel and Iran. A couple of weeks ago, Israel, the UK, and the US blamed Iran for a fatal drone attack on an Israeli-linked tanker in the Gulf. It's killed a British citizen and a Romanian. Iran accuses Israel of attacking its tankers and also assassinating an Iranian nuclear scientist and an attack on its Natanz nuclear facility. How dangerous is that? And is there a real risk that that can get out of hand, or can it be contained between these two arch enemies?
We have been watching this shadow war play out for a few years now. And of course, it's been escalating. And I think escalation is always a possibility. But despite the number of attacks that we've seen on tankers in the Mediterranean, in the Red Sea, in the Persian Gulf, cyber attacks and internal sabotage of Iran's nuclear infrastructure, killing of Iran's nuclear scientists. What's also been very clear is that for now, for the time being, neither side has the appetite for something more direct. And I think that is also sort of tempering Iran's ability to strike. It has limited ability to target Israel. And I think that's why it took the risk and it did hit this ship as part of its effort at pushing back in a limited way.
We've talked a lot about foreign policy, but perhaps Raisi's biggest challenge and the biggest test of whether his presidency will be deemed a success is actually what happens at home. Iran's under intense economic pressure because of crippling US sanctions imposed by Trump, its inability to export much oil, and then on top of that, the coronavirus pandemic, which has been awful in Iran. He's made it clear that he wants to ease the pressure on the Iranian populace. There have been sporadic protests. There were protests in the south recently over electricity cuts and water. How much of a challenge is it for him to maintain domestic stability, particularly if American sanctions remain in place and Iran can't export oil?
Well, the Iranian security establishment, I think, has honed a strategy for managing dissent, and we've seen them implement this strategy over repeated protests, not just in the 2019 protests, but there were protests in late 2017, early 2018, and just recently over the water protests and the electricity shortages, we saw a very sort of small-scale implementation where, of course, there's a heavy-handed response. You know, in the most recent protest, I think at least 8 people were killed. You know, the government sent in the IRGC and there was a clear effort at shutting the protests down to prevent them from spreading to other cities. They also, of course, arrested a number of protesters. They slowed, if not shut down, the internet in certain areas of the country, again, to stem the spread of the protests. And this time, actually, there was debate in the Iranian newspapers about the government response, and there was a bit of admission of culpability with President Rouhani, but also members of the incoming Raisi administration acknowledging that there had been, you know, government mismanagement over environmental issues. I think that in the climate of sanctions, that protests will continue. We also saw labor protests and labor strikes over the past months. And I think that there's a degree of confidence that using this strategy going forward is sort of the way to allow people to express their grievances, but also, you know, send clear messages to the Iranian population that ultimately dissent isn't going to be tolerated. And for Raisi, of course, sanctions relief would give him a head start in addressing the huge amount of economic challenges in the country. But I think it would be a mistake to assume that the Iranian government is going to make policy decisions based on sanctions relief. I think they feel relatively confident that they have weathered the brunt of the economic pain from the sanctions that were imposed, you know, gradually from 2018. And, you know, his number one priority will be to continue to invest in what is known as Iran's resistance economy, trying to make the economy more self-sufficient, and at the same time, try to address what he has called sort of systemic corruption in the Iranian political system and among the Iranian political elite. In the judiciary, he supposedly led an anti-corruption campaign, for example. So I think that he will try to implement policies. I don't know how effective they will be, but policies that will try to demonstrate his agenda of economic and social justice. And perhaps that could rehabilitate the Iranian political establishment with a portion of the Iranian population, not with, of course, the urban-based middle class that are definitely suffering, but maybe with individuals who see the Islamic Republic as ultimately being more productive and more stable.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of people from outside particularly would look at Raisi and his kind of reputation as this hardline state prosecutor. He was alleged to have been involved in political executions in the 80s. He was the judiciary chief before he became president. And, you know, he's going to crack down on society in Iran, people would assume. you know, going to reverse some of the gains that have happened over the last decade in terms of the treatment of women, the wearing of the hijab, use of social media and that kind of thing. But when I was in Tehran for the elections with our bureau chief, Najme Borzoghmeir, and we spoke to a lot of conservatives, and they said, actually, no. I mean, there's an acceptance among conservatives that society is evolving. There are some things that just are going to happen, the use of social media, the way women dress, these kind of things. You know, you can't roll that back. Society is just sort of pushing it forward. So whilst not going to allow protests or political dissent, you know, those social gains maybe could be protected. Do you believe that?
Yes, I would broadly agree with that. I mean, of course, we might see some ebbs and flows and, you know, some sort of local challenges where, you know, women are told they can't ride bicycles in certain conservative parts of the country. But I think broadly speaking, the political establishment in Iran, and particularly the conservative establishment and the Iranian deep state, to go back to that, are very conscious of how Iranian society has changed. They poll Iranians regularly, and they recognize that certain social freedoms and liberties give people air to breathe amid the climate of economic pressure, tensions with the United States, and, you know, reversing these gains and reversing these very subtle liberalizations, if you will, that are sort of informal, risk domestic security at the same time. So, you know, in the hierarchy of priorities, perhaps the hijab is not as high as domestic stability issues and, you know, managing broader urban concerns and environmental concerns. And I think that also all of these individuals have children, children who have grown up within this system, children who are ambitious and hungry for, you know, a more liberalized social life, if not economic opportunities that many of us take for granted in the West. So they're mindful of these shifts. And I think what we're going to see is a prioritization, as you said, of this resistance mentality. And that resistance mentality is, you know, designed to resist Western pressure and protect Iran's interests. And perhaps it's going to move away from that sectarianism and that Islamism that, you know, is often used to explain and sort of reduce the Islamic government of Iran's thinking. And instead, it's going to move more towards a nationalistic discourse. Whereas to protect the Islamic Republic, you have to pursue strategy and policy that is security-minded. And I think that that is, you know, how we should be thinking about the Islamic Republic. It's looking to survive.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that sort of pragmatism and the survival of the system is above everything else, because a lot of people will look at the Raisi election and everything that's going to be happening in Iran over the next decade or so is kind of geared towards succession. Succession to Khamenei. He's in his 80s. He wants to get his house in order, ensure a smooth succession after his death. And a lot of what we're seeing today reflects that. Will Raisi be the guy who succeeds him? I mean, a lot of people seem to be thinking that he is now the front runner. He's a protege of the supreme leader. He's a cleric. Has he been groomed for this?
Well, that's the $10 billion question. I have been writing about this for a while now, and I did a few years ago suggest that Raisi was among the front runners. And of all the candidates, you know, that people have put forward, I think the reason why Raisi is seen as the front runner is because he is the only public figure that is left among the others that have been identified. But I don't know if he is the only runner. There is a committee in the Assembly of Experts, the clerical body that is empowered to select the next supreme leader, that has supposedly put together a short list of candidates. I'm certain Raisi is on that short list, but no doubt there are other candidates and there are constituencies within the country that have different ideas for how the future of the Islamic Republic should be managed. And this is why the presidential election was seen to be so crucial, because, you know, had there been a bit more balance in the Iranian political system, reformists and pragmatists would have been able to engage in the debate around constitutional reform. But there are other candidates, perhaps, you know, looking at transition, I think, in the Soviet Union is something that the Iranian hardline political establishment, and particularly Khamenei, have been quite, I think, obsessed with. Khamenei himself, I think, is pushed back against too much glasnost and too much perestroika. So, you know, in succession, while many of us in the West and many liberally minded Iranians would like to see a Gorbachev candidate emerge, perhaps an older generation candidate might be found to hold the system together. And there are many people who think that Khamenei is also grooming his son, Mujtaba Khamenei, to succeed. I don't subscribe to that theory because this is an Islamic republic. For Khamenei to appoint his son would open the door to much criticism about his legacy, and it would, you know, be replicating a sort of monarchical dynamic that I think would be seen as very illegitimate. So, you know, much depends on what we see going forward, but part of this clearing of the decks and creating factional unity is designed to perhaps embark on constitutional reform and a new debate about how to move towards succession. And I think that that is very much going to drive the domestic priorities of the Raisi administration going forward.
That was Sanam Vakil, ending this edition of the Rachman Review. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week for more analysis of international affairs.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.